gentlemen. The first case this morning is Lukenheimer v. American United Life.
Good morning. I'm Eric Zagrins, representing the trustee of the Limekeuler Company's 401k plan. I'm delighted to share time this morning with my colleague from the Department of Labor. May it please the Court. The District Court committed two reversible errors in granting summary judgment in AUL's favor. First, it failed to recognize that this case is factually and legally distinguishable from this Court's decision in Hecker v. Deere, on which the Court extensively relied. And second, it inserted a key word, discretionary, into the test for fiduciary status that Congress didn't write into the relevant phrase of the statute. I will address each of these errors in turn. In this case, unlike in Hecker, the service provider, that's AUL, exercised the final say on how plan assets were invested, not the trustee.
So can I ask you an initial question about that? The question has to do with timing. So we have AUL with its sort of mirror image mutual funds. Obviously, it's an insurance company, so it had these separate accounts. And each one elected a share class, right? So was that election of share class done before or after the trustee decided on the funds that were going to be included within the plan?
Your Honor, it was done by AUL right up front.
When? At the time the trustee decided on the reason I'm interested is this. At this point, there are in excess of 370 mutual funds. I guess originally it was a much smaller number, but that doesn't matter. When the trustee decided which mutual funds to make available to participants in the plan, it's my understanding that the net price, the net number of basis points, whatever the price was going to be, was in fact disclosed. The component parts of that price were not disclosed, and only now, after this new regulation has come into effect, will they be. So if AUL had already selected a share class, then at the time the trustee selects the funds, the price is known. If AUL doesn't select the share class until after the funds are sitting there, then it seems to me we have a different situation. So I want to know what the record shows about the time in this overall process at which the share class is selected.
Your Honor, the record shows that with each mutual fund, AUL had already determined and selected the particular share class from among the multiple share classes that
right.
each mutual fund had. But here's the key point.
Doesn't that say, then, that at the time the trustee chooses what menu he's going to give the people in the plan and the net cost is disclosed, why isn't this, in fact, quite similar to Hecker, where we do, in fact, know what the price is, even though we don't know how it got made up?
Because the key distinction between this case and Hecker, Your Honor, is that AUL never informs the trustee that there's more than one share class in each mutual fund that the trustee offers to the plan participants to choose from.
But why
never
is
tells
that,
them that?
Why is that relevant? Because if you know the price, there are lots of mutual funds too, and some of them are very inexpensive with a small number of basis points. Some of them are more expensive, and so it's not clear to me why, if the trustee knows he's choosing from a group, anything untoward has happened by the trustee not saying, and there are also all sorts of other choices I could have been offering you.
Well, Your Honor, the trustee knows that he or she has a choice of this mutual fund, and this mutual fund. And he knows the price that AUL says is going to be charged to each fund, the expense ratio for each fund. What the trustee doesn't know, because AUL doesn't inform the trustee, is that there are more than one share class within each mutual fund to choose from, and therefore there are less expensive alternatives within the mutual fund, less
but
expensive share classes.
I understand that point, but what I don't understand is if, in fact, at the time the range of choices are put in front of the trustee for choosing what's going to go into the plan. That's why I keep using the word net. The net cost, including whatever revenue sharing is going to go on, including the price of the mutual fund as a whole, if that's all been factored in, then the trustee is making a reasonable choice. Now, I actually have some other questions about revenue sharing, because to read your brief, it seems as though these different share classes are differentiated solely by the cost. And I find that very difficult to believe. It seems to me maybe some of them offer more services than others, but I'd be very interested in what you think differentiates the share classes.
Your Honor, if I may address the first point you made, and then I'll talk about the cost differential. As to the first point, again, Your Honor, the plan trustee has an ERISA-imposed fiduciary duty to ensure that the service provider's fees and all other expenses of the investment are reasonable. And if the service provider, AUL, never tells the plan trustee that there are less expensive alternatives that the plan trustee could have chosen from, but AUL made the decision for the plan trustee and didn't, chose a more expensive alternative, and never tells the trustee, AUL has already determined, already made the selection, this is the share class if you choose this mutual fund.
So why
then
is that
it is
any
exercising
different?
Authority and control.
Well, I'm not sure whether that's the right characterization or whether it's simply a way of structuring the fund, because I take it you agree that that AUL could offer to the plan mutual funds that it thinks are very sound mutual funds, even if they come at a higher price.
Judge Wood, it's different from structuring the plan as in Hecker, where you take a panoply of hundreds or even thousands of mutual funds and you reduce it to a smaller menu to then offer to the plan trustee from which to choose.
And that step, of course, has also happened here. We don't have 7,500.
Absolutely. It did happen here, and that alone, standing by itself, does not confer fiduciary status on AUL. There's no question about that. Following Hecker. Hecker was correctly decided on its facts, but these facts are different because in Hecker, it was the ultimate say, the final say, was in the hands of the trustee. Here, AUL arrogated to itself the final say over selecting the share class, and the share class is the thing that determines the investment. That's when the investment is made.
And that's
the key distinction.
I understand that AUL chose the share class, and I guess the question is this something that causes it to become a functional fiduciary? And I also certainly can understand and in fact, I'm not even sure there's any debate about the reading that you propose of 10221A1, that there's discretionary authority or control about management, and then any authority about management or disposition of assets. I'm just not sure if it matters here, because we have this to the extent that aspect.
Well, it is to the extent that, and let me give you a concrete example, Your Honor, that may make this a little clearer. Let's take, for example, the Growth Fund of America, one of the mutual funds that we talk about in the brief. There were five different share classes, each with a different expense ratio, ranging from 39 basis points at the low end to about 1.5%, just under 1.5% on the high end.
So and what else differentiated the share classes?
Nothing, Your Honor. It was the same investment that was made in each share class. It was the same wrapper administrative fee that AUL charged on the front end. And the only difference, I understand Your Honor's skepticism, but truly the record reveals clearly that the only difference among the five share classes was the expense ratio along this continuum between 39 basis points and about 1.5%. And the only variable on the expenses was the amount of revenue sharing that would be shared by AUL. If there was more revenue sharing, the expense went up. If there was less revenue sharing, the expense went down. And AUL made sure that it always charged, it always selected a share class for which it got a higher amount of revenue sharing.
A three or four, but you said they tried not to get greedy.
Well, they didn't go at the extreme high end. That's right, Your Honor.
Yeah.
But they certainly didn't inform the trustee and let the trustee make the decision that there are lower cost alternatives for exactly the same investment opportunity. That is quintessentially exercising authority or control to the extent that it is making that final investment decision instead of offering it to the trustee to make, because the trustee is never told. I see that I'm eating into my rebuttal time, so unless there are other questions from the panel, I would like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, my name is Stephen Silverman on behalf of the Secretary. AUL contractually reserved for itself the final say over where the Lime Cooler Plan's assets were invested, and the District Court held that AUL alone determined which mutual fund share class Lime Cooler was invested in. AUL therefore exercised fiduciary authority and control over the Lime Cooler Plan's assets and had fiduciary obligation to the plan and its participants.
So let me ask you the same question, though. I take it you agree that if somebody in the position of AUL looks at the universe of the roughly 7,500 mutual funds out there and picks out, just to use a round number, 400 of them, that in and of itself is not a fiduciary act, or do you not agree with that?
It depends on whether the entity making that decision is retaining authority and control over the selection of investment options.
But
so, go ahead.
Well, okay. So I just want to make sure I follow your argument. So you think if AUL picks 400 and they say, we think this is a good group of 400, and they go to Mr. Limekeuler and they say, here's what we think would be a good deal for your plan. And I guess in scenario A, Mr. Limekeuler rubber stamps that. And in scenario B, he reviews that and he says, okay, you know, you weeded it through, but I like 300 of the ones you've presented, and actually I like somebody else that you didn't put in the mix. And Mr. Limekeuler has the ultimate control, as Deere did. Then that's the easy case. That's the case where it's the trustee who's doing it. But you think AUL is a fiduciary already if it just structures the plan to offer, looking through the independent entity in the middle, to offer the 400 funds?
No, Your Honor, not unless it retained authority and control over the selection of the fund. The final say that you speak of in Hecker. In Hecker, the plaintiffs alleged that Fidelity was a fiduciary merely because it played a role in the selection of investment options. But the plaintiffs conceded that Deere, not Fidelity, had the final say in the selection of investment options.
Now the other side, the AUL people, say that similarly Mr. Limekeuler had a final say.
Well, Your Honor, the contract that we rely on, Section 3.3 of the contract, provides for really unfettered control and final say over the mutual fund selection. And this case was ruled on at summary judgment, Your Honor. So construing the contract in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, which is Lime Cooler, it surely is a basis for denying summary judgment, because that provision of the contract, Section 3.3, surely can be read as conferring unfettered control and discretion over the Lime Cooler Plan's assets.
I thought the facts in this case, though, were that the retained authority was not exercised, or at least not in a way relevant to the claim here.
But there was an exercise, Your Honor. It's not the case that, as in Hecker, Lime Cooler merely picked a mutual fund and then AUL had nothing else to do, nothing else to say. That would be Hecker, because Fidelity had no further say in what was selected. In this case, Lime Cooler picked the fund, and then AUL has the authority and control to determine which share class the investments are invested in. I would analogize this, Your Honor, to a...
So just to interrupt, so you think that the fund is picked first, and then after the plan participant says, you know, I like the America Growth Fund, then AUL decides which share class? I mean, because it was my understanding on this record, which certainly could be wrong, it's a long record, that as in Hecker, the final net price of each fund, which would include revenue sharing, share class, and all the rest of it, was already determined by the time the plan decides which mutual funds it's going to have.
Right. So, Your Honor, AUL takes the position that the share class was initially selected, and then Lime Coolers came in and said, we want to pick a certain mutual fund.
Right.
And then, after that, AUL retains the authority to either go forward with that share class or pick a different share class. I would analogize this, Your
Honor.
But
did it ever, as Judge Sykes asked, did it ever exercise that authority? I thought there were only two instances in the record, one too long ago to be cognizable now, and the other dealing with Vanguard, which doesn't do revenue sharing. So is there any exercise of this authority that we can see in this record?
Yes, Your Honor. Every single time LimeCool invested the assets. I would analogize this to a game of cards, Your Honor, poker. Five card draw. You're dealt five cards, and then you have the option to discard one, two, or three cards, or you can play the five cards that you were dealt. Nobody would say that the decision to play the initial hand, the five cards that you were dealt, is not an exercise of authority over the cards that you're playing.
Okay, your analogy reads out the statutory language to the extent that.
No, Your Honor, because there's been an exercise of authority over that hand, where they could have selected one to discard one, two, or three of the options. In the same way that AUL here had picked an option, and then it chose to go forward with that option, even though it could have picked a share class that would have cost less to LimeCooler, cost less to LimeCooler, and increase the assets to the plan. To be sure, AUL could have written the contract to abrogate or limit its authority and control over the LimeCooler plan's assets. All it had to do was provide a contract with LimeCooler that would require it to provide notice of any investment decisions with the assets, as well as veto power over any of those investment decisions. That is an arrangement that the Secretary described over 15 years ago in an advisory opinion that the briefs before the court described as referred to as the Aetna letter. And that is an arrangement that is similar to the arrangement between Fidelity and Deere in the Hecker case. Because AUL failed to divest itself of the final say, the final authority over where the assets went, as in Hecker and as with Fidelity and as in the Aetna letter, neither Hecker nor the Aetna letter applies in this case.
Why is that required as opposed to an affirmative exercise of the retained authority to get you into the fiduciary box?
There has been an affirmative exercise.
That was conceded, not denied. It was conceded by the trustee at summary judgment that there was no substitution of the share class after the fact.
There's been no substitution, but the decision to continue with the same share class when they have the authority and control over the plan assets is an exercise in and of itself, Your Honor. It can't be the case that where an entity has authority and control over plan assets, that it has the authority to set its own compensation, essentially, without having any fiduciary obligation to the plan.
That is a theory that doing nothing triggers the fiduciary duty?
They're not doing nothing, Your Honor. They chose to invest in the share class that they initially selected. If they wanted to do nothing, they could have abrogated their own responsibility, much like a directed trustee. A directed trustee has authority over assets, but has no meaningful ability to exercise that authority because the directed trustee must merely follow the instructions. In this case, AUL does not argue that they are a directed trustee, but rather they have retained the authority and control over the plan assets when they could have chosen a share class that would cost less to the plan, but they opted to choose share classes that were necessary to meet their own revenue sharing goals. Your Honor, the district court's opinion should be reversed because AUL did exercise authority and control over the plan assets every time LimeCooler invested.
Thank you, Mr. Silva.
May it please the Court. Eric Mattson on behalf of the defendant, American United Life Insurance Company. I want to begin by answering Judge Wood's question about timing that we started talking about this morning. Timing is critically important in this case. We would be talking about a very different case if Mr. Limekuhler came to AUL, said, I want to put my participants' money in the ABC Mutual Fund. You just go decide how much it's going to cost me. That would be a very different case, but that is not this case. And frankly, if that was the way that AUL did business, it would be out of business in about 5 minutes because this is a competitive marketplace. There are many different insurance companies and other types of companies competing for this business. But that's not the facts that we have in front of us. The record is quite clear.
So let me ask you two questions that at least for me are very important. One of them is whether on this record it shows that the plan is told what the overall cost of each possible mutual fund is, net of revenue sharing, net of basis point, you know, whatever components go into that. Are they told that? And then my second question is, if you can explain to me, maybe you agree with Mr. Zagranz that the only difference among these share classes is that some of them are cheap and some of them are expensive and with much more revenue sharing. Explain to me why these price differences exist.
Sure. To answer the first question, the answer is yes, they are told. And we collected various parts of the record in our SIR reply that we were granted leave to file that talks about that fact. The answer to the second question is Mr. Zagranz is correct. The investments, the underlying investments made by the mutual funds do not vary share class to share class. The reason, at least my understanding for the reason for different share classes, is that mutual fund companies are selling to different markets. If I walk in literally off the street to a broker's office and say, here's $500, I want to invest it in the ABC Mutual Fund, I'm going to get a share class that has a higher expense ratio than if I'm, say, IBM, and I'm investing, you know, billions in a particular mutual fund through a 401k plan.
And is that because of services rendered or economies of scale? I mean, what's the quid pro quo?
It's economies of scale. Is again my understanding. I can't claim expertise on that particular question, but I believe it's a matter of economies of scale. Just like a manufacturer, if they're selling to Walmart, is going to charge less. So too, if a mutual fund company is selling to somebody who's buying a huge number of shares, they can charge less. I also wanted to respond to what Mr. Silverman from the department talked about. It really is, Judge Sykes, a matter of the theory now being that doing nothing makes you a fiduciary. And if there's anything clear about the definition of fiduciary under ERISA, at least this prong of it, you have to do something. It's not a question of what you might do or what you could have done. It's a question of what you did do. And if you exercise authority or control over the management or disposition of plan assets, then when you do that, you're a fiduciary. If you're not doing those things, then you're not. And the record is quite clear in this case that AUL was not doing those things. It was, as the district court said at page 15 of its opinion, it was offering plan sponsors a pre-selected universe of mutual funds of pre-selected share classes that plan sponsors can choose to include in their plans or not. Then the court said you're not exercising authority or control. That's what happened in this case.
So let me ask you this. I mean, out there in the world, if you walking in to invest $500 to some broker's office, wanted to consider which mutual fund you wanted to do, you'd have a discussion. And it was my thought that the mutual funds disclose, you know, what the cost. I mean, they have to. I mean, you're going to take that into your investment decision. So would you be able to find out right there that, oh, gee, you know, if I, instead of just doing this as an individual, if I went back to my company and did it through my 401k, I'd get a better deal? I mean,
I believe so. I believe that the prospectuses list the various different available share classes. There's no secret.
So this is not a secret fact that there are share classes.
Oh, absolutely not. You can. I don't know if you're allowed to, as judges, do a Google search to find information about share classes. It's quite well-known in the industry. And the idea that AUL had a duty to tell Mr. Limekeeler, hey, you know, you can get a better deal somewhere else, if that isn't indeed the case. I'm not sure that he could, given the size of the plan. That's just not found anywhere in ERISA.
So it's your position that the fact that there are share classes for America Growth is a publicly discernible fact. If
Absolutely.
Somebody like Mr. Limekeeler wanted to look behind the various mutual funds that were being presented.
Absolutely. And just to explain a little bit more about how the marketing process generally works, AUL does not have its own salespeople who go out and pitch to 401k plans. It relies on a network of independent agents who can sell AUL services or principal life insurance services or the services of any number of other competitors. And so, and you can see this in, you can glean this in the deposition testimony of Jim Jackson and Ernie Wright that are in the supplemental, in the joint appendix. So these salespeople go out and they talk to prospective clients and they solicit bids from AUL and Principal and whoever else they work with. And one of the key discussion points is how much will this cost? And sometimes the 401k plan trustee will choose the plan the service provider that's a little more expensive because they perceive that they're going to get better service or for some other reason. But as often as not, price is the driver. So that's just a little bit of background to help the court understand how this works in the real world.
So I want to turn for a minute to this issue of discretion, because obviously in the law of trusts, you know, one way that a trustee can be liable is if the trustee abuses discretion and doesn't perform in the best interest of the plan. But disloyal acts are also reachable. You know, you might have no discretion at all as AUL. You've been told these are the funds to invest in, and if you take the money and instead invest it on your favorite villa in northern Italy, you surely can be sued for that.
Absolutely.
You know, so the key is less discretion than potential liability of the trustee under the general concepts that the law of trusts recognizes.
And to put it in the ERISA context, if AUL did that, took money that Mr. Limekeeler gave it and went off and bought a villa in Italy, it would at that point be exercising control over those assets. It's not putting the money where Mr. Limekeeler or the plan participants told it to put that money. It's doing something else with it.
Right. So it's exercising control. And I just want to make it clear that even though there's really no discretion to do that, it's still an exercise of control. It still falls within the second half of the definition that we're talking about.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, I know there's been a lot of talk about discretion in some decisions that didn't present this exact set of facts, but it's helpful sometimes to be more precise.
Right. Right.
So the ultimate difference between you is really the extent to which AUL, by making the decision on its own which share class is the appropriate one for each fund, I gather in advance of it being put into the plan, whether that's enough of an exercise of control to trigger the potential liability here.
It's plainly not, and if that were the rule, then Hecker would have been decided differently. There are some distinctions between this case and Hecker, but on this one, there's no distinction. When Fidelity went to market with only Fidelity-branded funds, that's all they were made available on its investment menu, each of those funds was associated with a particular share class. They have to be. By SEC rule. And so if offering less than the total number of share classes were enough, then Hecker would have been decided differently. The other point I want to make in response to that, Judge Wood, is that it's not as if, let's say Mr. Limekeeler had come in and said, you know what, AUL, I like you, I want to hire you, but I want a lower share class. I want a less expensive share class. If AUL had been willing to do that, then the wrap fee or some other fee that it charged Mr. Limekeeler would have had to go up. because it needs to make what it needs to make in order to stay in business. So in some ways, the idea that getting a cheaper share class would mean a less expensive plan is not correct.
Well, at least it's not proven. I mean, we don't know how it all would have worked its way through the system. Now, what about this point about Mr. Limekuhler's role, if any, in the selection of the funds that were going to be offered by the plan? Am I correct that this is at least different from Hecker in that respect, where in Hecker it was Deere with the final control, obviously in consultation with Fidelity and whomever? But what about that?
Mr. Limekuhler did have final control over whichever options on the AUL menu he would choose. He worked in consultation with an independent advisor, Marco Mazzoni, mm-hmm. and together they were the ones who decided. But Mr. Limekuhler admitted at his deposition he was the one who had final say, final decision over which ones would be offered.
So how can he make an intelligent decision, though, if he doesn't know which moving parts are involved?
Are you referring to revenue sharing?
Yeah, revenue sharing.
That's a fair question. Now, and that was one of the points that Mr. Zagrins was making. Well, he knows the total cost, but he doesn't know who, as between the mutual fund company and AUL, is getting which slice, ultimately, of that total cost.
And he doesn't know how it would have netted out. I mean, I take your point that if something's actually happening with these dollars, then maybe it needs to be paid for in a different way. But it's not always a one-to-one swap.
Perhaps not. But the point I wanted to make is that he knows the total cost, which is ultimately what matters. You can make a policy argument that it's better for the trustee to have more knowledge about how this money gets carved up after the fact. And because of those policy arguments, the Department of Labor passed a regulation that requires more disclosure. Now, AUL, as it happens, has been disclosing this for several years now as the industry has moved towards more transparency on this particular point. As I say, those are fair questions, but those are more public policy questions. They really don't address the question that is fundamental to this particular appeal, which is fiduciary status.
You've got a cross appeal, part of which is contingent on the fiduciary status decision and part of which is not. Perhaps you'd like to move to that?
We'll rest on our briefs on those points, so unless the court has other questions that I can answer, I'll finish.
Thank you, counsel.
If Your Honor pleases, just three quick points in rebuttal. First, Judge Sykes, we agree that doing nothing does not make one a fiduciary.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
You have to do something to, under the statute, exercise authority or control to the extent, as the statute says. Okay. Judge Wood, back to your concern about the disclosure of the net expense ratio up front, please let me be very clear and very precise about what the record discloses. And by the way, contrary to the impression that's being made here, AUL did not disclose the existence of separate share classes or what it was doing to Limekuhler until after this lawsuit was filed.
But was what this was publicly available information?
Well, you know, they didn't give us a prospectus. So to the extent, it's in the prospectus, take a look at it. If you're dealing with a service provider like AUL in good faith, I think a plan trustee has the right to expect that it's going to present the relevant information without having to do some extensive internet search to dig out the final answer. But more to the point, at the beginning, the separate account expense ratio was in fact disclosed at the beginning. Okay? But the mutual fund expense ratio is not disclosed at the beginning. And as a matter of fact, as the record indicates, AUL wouldn't deal with any mutual fund that wouldn't agree right up front to give it revenue sharing. What AUL had was a deal. Let's keep to that Growth Fund of America example that I used before. They had a deal with the Growth Fund of America before ever hearing about Limekuhler 401k plan to pick five different share classes within that particular mutual fund for any of its clients that would invest in that. Okay? But then AUL, not the trustee, chose one of two share classes, never chose the other three. The other three were the lower expenses that it never got around to doing and never told the trustee that it had an opportunity to pick one of those lower ones. AUL chose one of the two share classes that the money would, from the Limekeuler plan, the plan participant money, would be invested in. And the focus on overall cost in the Hecker case was perfectly appropriate, because in the Hecker case, the plaintiffs were plan participants. And the court said, quite correctly, that plan participants don't have to know all of these details so long as the plan trustee is informed. In this case, it is the plan trustee who was not informed and who did not make the final decision, completely unlike Hecker. So for the reasons of the distinction between this case and Hecker, and because the district court erroneously said only if AUL exercised discretionary authority or control in contravention to the statute could it be held liable, for both of those reasons, the court should reverse and remand for proceedings on the merits. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.